You're listening to the English language news of Khan, the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation.
It's 8 p.m. in Israel, Wednesday, April the 24th, 2024, in the headlines. The Hamas terror group has released a propaganda video with a first sign of life from captivity of Israeli-American hostage Hirsch Goldberg Polin. The IDF chief of staff and Shin Bet chief held talks in Cairo as the Israeli military prepares for an offensive in Rafah. Defense Minister Gallant says Israel has killed half of Hezbollah's South Lebanon commanders. The rest are in hiding. U.S. President Biden signs an aid package law that includes billions of dollars in military assistance to Israel. Columbia University says it's engaged in dialogue with protesters to scale down a pro-Palestinian encampment on campus. The weather outlook, extremely hot. Good evening. This is Nomi Segal with the news. On day 201 of the war and amid IDF preparations for a military offensive in Rafah, the Hamas terror group released a new propaganda video showing a sign of life from captivity of 23-year-old Israeli-American hostage Hirsch Goldberg Polin. In the video, which is believed to have been filmed in recent days, Goldberg Polin is seen with his left hand amputated. Goldberg Polin was abducted from the Supernova rave near Re'im on October 7th and is known to have been wounded in the left arm by grenades Hamas terrorists lobbed into the roadside shelter where he and others who tried to seek safety had fled. The Hostages Families Forum headquarters issued a statement following the release of the video saying, "Hirsch's cry is the collective cry of all the hostages. Their time is rapidly running out. We cannot afford to waste any more time. The hostages must be the top priority. All the hostages must be brought home, those alive to begin the process of rehabilitation, and those murdered for a dignified burial." The forum said the distressing video serves as an urgent call to take swift and decisive action to resolve this horrific humanitarian crisis and ensure the safe return of our loved ones. 133 hostages are held in Gaza, not all of them alive. Following the release of the video of Hirsch Goldberg Polin, dozens of protesters gathered opposite the prime minister's residence in Jerusalem this evening, demanding a hostage release deal now. Meanwhile, turning to the north, in a wave of strikes over a short period this afternoon, the IDF struck dozens of Hezbollah targets in South Lebanon. An army statement said Israel Air Force fighter jets and artillery struck some 40 Hezbollah targets, including weapons storehouses, munitions, terror infrastructure, and other targets. This is part of the effort to destroy the organization's infrastructure along the border area. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said today the coming period along the northern border will be critical. During consultations at the IDF Northern Command, Gallant stressed the need to advance operational actions that will make it possible for the residents of the north to return to their homes if diplomatic efforts to resolve the matter fail. He stressed that there is an ongoing IDF operation through all of South Lebanon. He said half of Hezbollah commanders in South Lebanon have been killed. These are people who were responsible for attacks on Israel. The other half are hiding or have fled. This evening, rocket alerts sounded in Majdal Shams in the northern Golan Heights. Several landing sites of missiles fired from Lebanon were identified in open areas. Hezbollah said it fired rockets towards an IDF position on Hardov. Earlier today, the Iran-backed group claimed responsibility for four barrages on northern Israel since the morning hours. In Moshav Avivim, two houses and a trailer were damaged by anti-missile fire from Lebanon. A fire broke out near Kibbutz Yaron from a missile. No one was hurt. Five launches were identified earlier at Shtula and Netua on the northern border. No one was hurt. There's still no electricity in much of Moshav Margaliot because of missile fire yesterday. And in the south, rocket alerts sounded in Sderot this evening. An interception was reported, and later fragments from an interceptor missile landed on a building in Sderot. No one was hurt, though several people were treated for shock. Since yesterday, six rockets were fired at Sderot. Earlier today, rocket alerts sounded in Kisufim in the Gaza periphery. Two rockets fell in open areas in the earlier salvo. There were no reports of injury or damage. The release of the Hamas video of Hirsch Goldberg Polin came as Israel is preparing for the IDF is preparing for an expanded operation in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, and amid an impasse in hostage release talks. The expanded cabinet is due to convene tomorrow afternoon in the Kiryat Defense compound in Tel Aviv. Econ reporter says ministers are expected to discuss, among other things, a ground operation in Rafah. Econ reporter adds the war cabinet is also expected to meet tomorrow. The IDF chief of staff, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, and the Shin Bet agency head, Ronen Bar, traveled to Cairo this morning and met with the Egyptian intelligence chief, Abbas Kamel. This against the backdrop of preparations for an Israeli military ground offensive in Rafah and Egyptian concerns it will bring a wave of Gazans fleeing into its territory. Econ reporter says the IDF is preparing to prevent such a surge along the Philadelphia route between Gaza and Egypt. A senior defense establishment official said the IDF has made all the needed preparations and can begin the operation in Rafah as soon as the signal is given by the government. Earlier, Khan reported that the IDF is preparing for a ground operation soon in Rafah that will initially include a large-scale evacuation of the civilian population. More than 1 million Palestinians in Rafah will have to move to shelters that have been erected in the last few months in the southern and central Gaza Strip. The prevailing assessment is that the evacuation will take between 4 to 5 weeks. The IDF's progress in the operation will be in stages and divided into defined areas. The plan has been presented to the United States and to countries in the region. Satellite photos taken by Planet Labs that were published yesterday showed a new tent compound near Khan Yunis. The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that Egyptian officials had been apprised of the Israeli evacuation plan. And according to previous reports, it includes the purchasing of tens of thousands of tents for those who will be evacuated from Rafah, some of whom have already moved on their own to the Khan Yunis area after IDF troops left the city last month. Egyptian officials said that the evacuation operation could take between 2 to 3 weeks and that it would be coordinated with Washington, Cairo, and other Arab states, such as the United Arab Emirates. They said that Israel was planning to move troops into Rafah gradually and to focus on areas where the security establishment believes Hamas leaders are hiding. An Israeli security official said, told the newspaper that the operation would be complicated and that humanitarian needs would need to be addressed. Against the backdrop of these developments, the IDF has called up two reservists brigades for offensive and defensive missions in the Gaza Strip. The IDF spokesperson's office said the combatants had drilled battle techniques and had learned the insights and lessons from the fighting in the Gaza Strip up until now. An Israeli government spokesman confirmed Israel is moving ahead with the operation to target Hamas in Rafah and will make every effort to move civilians out of harm's way. David Mensur of the National Public Diplomacy Directorate made the remarks in an online briefing.
I can confirm Israel is moving ahead with our operation to target Hamas in Rafah. We will, as usual, be making every effort to move civilians out of harm's way as we have done in the past. We believe that we've destroyed at least 18 or 19 of Hamas's 24 battalions, but the four battalions which remain in Rafah cannot be shielded from Israel. They will be attacked, and we do this for the simple reason, as Benny Gantz, our minister in the security cabinet, has said very, very clearly, we cannot put out 80% of this Hamas genocidal army fire and leave 20% still roaring, because that 20% will retake Gaza, they will regroup and retake Gaza, and they will attack us again. They wish to do October the 7th again, and we will not let that happen. We refuse to live next to this genocidal, poisonous terror army anymore.
Has Israel satisfied the U.S. that Palestinian civilians in Rafah will be relocated safely, and which foreign countries, if any, are helping with this relocation?
We are, of course, informing all countries in the region, the countries where we have good relations, we are continuing to inform them of our intentions, so they are fully aware. And when it comes to moving civilians out of harm's way, that is a key part of Israel's war strategy, to ensure that no civilians are harmed. As much, as far as humanly possible, we get civilians out of harm's way, as we have done in the past, which has resulted, as General Petraeus, Colonel John Spencer, Colonel Richard Kemp have all said, have resulted in the gold standard of civilian to terrorist ratio when it comes to the results of this war. We are going after Hamas. We will not leave these four battalions still standing.
David Mentzer of the National Public Diplomacy Directorate. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry said Egypt called on Israel not to take military steps in Rafah and that this was the position of the international community. He said a military operation in a densely crowded area would cause civilian fatalities, more suffering and expulsion, and trying to finish off the Palestinian issue by means of migration. Jordan's King Abdullah and the Emir of Kuwait, Sabah, called on the UN Security Council to pass a binding resolution requiring a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. In a joint statement issued after a meeting in Jordan, the two leaders said that they oppose an Israeli ground operation in Rafah or any other operation that would expand the war. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safdie, also called for doing everything possible to prevent an offensive on Rafah. Funeral details were yet to be announced for the IDF reservist Sergeant First Class Salam al-Krashat, age 42, of the Bedouin community of Abu Rabia, who was killed in battle in the northern Gaza Strip yesterday. The soldier served as a tracker in the northern brigade of the Gaza Division. His death brought to 606 the number of IDF soldiers who have fallen since the beginning of the war. The Air Force attacked more than 50 Hamas terror targets in the Gaza Strip. Combat jets destroyed two launching sites that were established inside the humanitarian area in the southern Gaza Strip. In addition, troops killed terrorists and destroyed terrorist infrastructure in the corridor in the central Gaza Strip in the last 24 hours. A pro-Qatari newspaper reported this morning that Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas Gaza leader, recently went above ground and visited sites where battles took place against IDF troops. The Al-Arabi Al-Jadid newspaper cited a senior Hamas official who also said that Sinwar met with Hamas operatives. He said Sinwar was not isolated from events in Gaza and that in talks and between the Hamas leadership in Gaza and the overseas leadership, Sinwar updated the latter on the situation with precise numbers and said the Palestinian factions had the ability and the power to cope with the IDF. Meanwhile, Hamas has denied reports that no more than 20 of the 133 hostages held in Gaza are alive. A senior source in the terror organization told the newspaper Al-Arabi Al-Jadid that it is impossible to give the exact number of hostages who are alive, but it is possible to say with certainty it is higher than reported in Israeli media. A Hamas source also denied reports that the terror group had proposed only releasing 20 hostages instead of the 40 discussed in the first phase of a ceasefire deal proposed by mediators. According to Palestinian sources, Hamas proposed releasing 20 hostages, all civilians, in the first stage, and during a pause in the fighting, a pause would be used to search for other civilians held hostage in Gaza. Qatar says there's no justification to end the presence of an office for Hamas in Doha while its mediation efforts continue in the Gaza war. The foreign ministry spokesperson, Majid Al-Ansari, also confirmed that Qatar remains committed to mediation, but was reassessing its role amid frustration with attacks on its efforts.
Regarding the Hamas office here in Doha, this office was opened in coordination with the United States for the purpose of mediation between both sides, as long as their presence here in Doha, as we have always said, is useful and positive in this mediation effort, they will remain here in Doha. That said, of course, as we said, we are reassessing our role as mediators, but any decisions regarding this issue will not be taken unless we are finished with that reassessment and we are ready to convey the results of this reassessment. We have deep frustration with such statements, especially when they come out of officials who are part of the establishment and understand exactly what the Qatari role and what the Qatari coordination with the international community has been over the mediation and over its humanitarian role. And that is one of the reasons why we are now reassessing our role as mediators.
Former national that would be the Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesperson, Majd al-Ansari. Dr. Eyal Hulata, a former national security advisor in the Bennett-Lapid government and currently a senior international fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, told the Jerusalem Press Club of the anticipated Rafah offensive that it seems clear to all at this juncture that Hamas is not interested in a hostage release deal that would allow a path for a ceasefire. He also commented on the situation in the northern arena.
I think the main things to look at is clearly the fact that it seems like Hamas is not really interested in a hostage deal, unfortunately, and that does not allow for a path for a ceasefire that I think everybody is looking for. Almost everybody is looking for. You're all stationed in Israel. I'm sure you're following. I think there's a growing majority of Israelis who understand the need to bring the hostages back before it's too late. The number of live hostages is on the decline by the day, by the week. I think there's a strong sense that we're running out of time on behalf of their on their sake for this. But of course, to have a deal, Hamas needs to agree, Sinwar needs to agree, and unfortunately, he does not feel that time is running out for him for a host of reasons. Part of it is militarily, of course, but I think a huge part of it is diplomatically. When Sinwar looks at what's happening and he sees the amount of pressure on Israel in the international community and the rise of the voices that are calling for ceasefire without a hostage deal, I'm sure that gives him encouragement. And in parallel to that, neither the Qataris nor the Egyptians, which hold the financial lifeline on the one hand and the physical lifeline on the other hand, are not pushing him to come to a deal and reach a ceasefire. So it seems, unfortunately, that Sinwar feels that he has room to maneuver. As long as that will be the case, I think we can't expect a hostage deal. In such a case, the only option that Israel has is to continue to pursue militarily. There are, I think, no other options. I think the Americans understand that. I believe that the European leaders understand that as well. And what we should expect in this regard to see in the coming weeks is the mobilization of the program to move the civilians from Rafah. It's not only civilians, it's also field hospitals and infrastructure that was built down in the south, moved elsewhere, and the IDF has a plan for that so that they can create condition that would allow them to operate in Rafah without endangering civilians in an unreasonable way. This will be, I think, the main thing to look at in the following weeks. Of course, to it is attached the importance of diplomatic collaboration with the Egyptians. This cannot happen while the Egyptians do not at least understand or acknowledge the need for that and do things on their part. The Egyptians are worried from day one that Gazans will cross through the border into Sinai and make this their problem, even though it could have been a very important humanitarian relief for the civilians of Gaza if they could temporarily move to Sinai. But President Sisi has refused to do this from day one. There will need to be some kind of coordination with them so that this doesn't damage the fragility of relationship as it is already at the moment. This is what we should look for, I think, in the context of Gaza.
Do you think that now is the time to move forward with such an operation? How do you see that playing out specifically, you know, from where you're sitting in Washington in terms of the support that we might have from our strongest ally in the West?
Yeah. So first, as it comes to Israel, I think what we've seen, as I said in the beginning, I think the analysis in Israel is that we cannot have a hostage deal at the moment. Sinwar won't give it to us. We see, by the way, I haven't talked about this in the beginning of the briefing, and this wasn't asked. I hope this is because you all recognize that Israel is doing way more than it did initially on the humanitarian aid to the Gazans. Those of you who've heard me before, then you know for a fact, I've been saying this from the initial brief. After the war started, I think I said back then, Israel needs to push a lot of humanitarian aid into Gaza. This should not be a bargaining part of the conflict. And I think what you see over the last 2-3 weeks since that very unfortunate, horrific strike on the World Kitchen, World Center Kitchen workers, unfortunately, a very unfortunate incident. You see a lot more. I think Israel should have done that before. But in any case, there is a lot more aid coming into Gaza. So given the fact that there is no hostage deal, and given the fact that there is a lot more humanitarian aid to the Gazans, I think there is an understanding also by the administration that Israel, there is not more that we can do, right? If they agree with our goals, which is to remove Hamas from ruling Gaza, to bring back the hostages, creating new conditions in Gaza, Israel is exhausting its means. And I think we should expect the administration to understand that and to back Israel as we move ahead also towards an operation in Rafah. Of course, the civilians, as I said, will need to be evacuated. And the program for that, I expect us all to start seeing in the motion. And let's see how this plays out. Will that change Sinwar's calculus? Maybe. I don't think so, but it might.
Regarding the Northern Front itself, you posed, you know, a very logical dilemma that there's kind of a chicken and egg scenario in terms of whether the evacuees can return home as long as their homes are being bombed, but then Hezbollah is able to continue bombing when nobody is there. How do we risk a situation in which at the end of the day, many families won't end up returning home at all, and then we really have, you know, kind of this abandoned periphery on our northern border?
Well, that would be very unfortunate if this is the case. Israelis cannot be in exile in their own country. This cannot happen. This is the responsibility of the government, of the IDF, to defend the civilians. This is what we failed to do on October 7, and we have to regain that. And I know that even though on April 13, we have been able to prove what Israel really is when we are prepared in defending our civilians, this has little effect on the feeling of the people of the north, and also, by the way, of the people of the south. They are not going back to their homes either, even though there are not many rockets. I think there are more rockets on the communities in the north than there are rockets in the communities in the south this far along into the war with Gaza. Ultimately, this is the responsibility of the government, to restore the trust of the people in the country so that they can go back to their homes. I happen to think that it was a mistake to evacuate all of the people from the north when they started. My late grandfather lived in the north of Israel during the independence war, and they knew that the women, the children, will retreat from the communities, but the men will stay to fight, because this is what the Israeli ethos was for years. In times of conflict, there were times where our borders were war zones all across in 48, could have been also in 67. It didn't happen because we took the preventive action before the attack. But in 48, I think the decision to evacuate everybody was a mistake. I think that the government should have been more thoughtful in the implication that, of course, there was chaos. Everybody were in trauma. I think the government was very afraid that things will go rouge in the north the way they went in the south. But, you know, in hindsight, everything is easier. In any case, we're where we are. I think they need to strike a decision. And if we're not, and I don't think we should at the moment go into a full-fledged war with Lebanon, we need to finish what we have in Gaza. And hopefully the international community can start doing something about 1701 that was not respected, I think, for a day since it was approved almost 18 years ago. But we cannot continue this way. We need to create a new balance with Hezbollah to deliver the dilemma to them. I don't think they will fire on civilians in large quantities the way they do now, because they don't want a war just as much as we don't. But we'll need to be brave in this. Is the Israeli government capable of being brave and leading its people? We'll have to see. But I think that's important.
Former National Security Advisor Dr. Eyal Chulata. The head of the Meroma Galil Regional Council, Amit Sofer, said earlier today the state must provide economic backing to residents of the battered north. He told Khan that the hourglass of resilience is emptying and is not infinite. Those communities beyond the 9-kilometer range from the northern border currently have no economic framework and no economic horizon. He said in order to prevent Hezbollah from chalking up an achievement, the state must provide backing for residents of the Galilee. In other news, a stabbing attack was averted at the Ha'okfim Junction near Hebron today. Soldiers at an army position shot to death a woman terrorist who ran at them with a knife. No soldiers were injured. Earlier in the week, at another nearby intersection, troops killed a terrorist who shot at them and another terrorist who tried to stab soldiers. Hikers on a moonlit walk in the area of Arad last night came upon remains of an Iranian missile several meters long from the Iranian attack on Israel Saturday night a week ago that was repelled. A Khan reporter says the IDF Homefront Command and police were dealing with the situation. Families of hostages and their supporters held several events last night to mark the 200th day of the war and their loved ones' captivity. In Tel Aviv, some of the demonstrators threw pita bread soaked in red paint at the Kiryat Defense Ministry compound to protest what they called the security cabinet members' contempt for their loved ones. Here are voices from the Tel Aviv protest last night.
Because for 200 days we have the hostages kidnapped to Gaza, and it's just atrocious, impossible. People in the world need to understand what's happening here in Israel. We were attacked. We were almost destroyed as a nation. And I don't understand why we don't have a million people here in the streets. It will come. It will come because we have to down the government. We have to change what's happening in Israel. We have to rebuild the country again. The anti-Semitism in the world is rising. And we Jews, we only have one place to be here. And this is the land. And we have to rebuild the land and live here in peace.
Actually cannot trust the leadership, and if you can't trust the leadership, the biggest problem is the army, because army and Israeli army is the best army in the world, but army must have targets, goals. Army must know, okay, we want us to do this and this and this. This doesn't happen today, and this really disturbs me, because without the army, I don't think we can get the hostages back. I don't think we can solve the Gaza.
Voices from Tel Aviv last night. Turning to the campus protests in the United States, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lambasted what he called an anti-Semitic surge amid anti-Israel pro-Palestinian protests on university campuses across the U.S. In an English language video, Netanyahu said anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It's unconscionable. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned unequivocally. But that's not what happened. When you listen to them, they say not only death to Israel and death to the Jews, but also death to America, he said. Opposition leader Yair Lapid has urged the Biden administration to act as the pro-Palestinian demonstrations spread to more university campuses. Some of the protests have included calls for violence and alleged harassment of Jewish students. On many of the campuses, protesters set up unauthorized encampments of tents to press their demands, most notably at Columbia University in New York City. Lapid said, "What's happening on American college campuses is unforgivable. It is anti-Semitism. It is support for terrorism. The administration cannot stand by." The White House said yesterday it was monitoring the situation at college campuses closely, saying people have the right to publicly protest, but not physical intimidation or calls for violence, citing some alarming rhetoric. Reporter Mark Weiss spoke with Lahav Harkov from the Misgav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy about the protests.
First of all, if you can bring our listeners up to date with what exactly is happening on campuses in America.
So, you know, there's many thousands of college campuses across the United States, and a large number of them, especially the ones that are sort of considered elite campuses, are having massive anti-Israel demonstration movements, tent camps and things like that, that have been, for months now, really harassing and threatening and in a few cases actually executing violence against Jewish students. They claim Zionist students, but it's basically all the Jewish students and sometimes faculty on campus. And in the last weekend, what's gotten a lot of attention is Columbia University in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, where there's really, large numbers of these tents, which, by the way, does not look like a people spontaneously took out their camping gear. They're all the same kind of tent, which, I don't have the answer to who and when bought them those tents, but it looks very organized. And they're blocking what they call quote-unquote Zionist students from entering campus. They're saying threatening things. They're saying go back to Poland. They're saying burn down Tel Aviv. They've been calling for the elimination of Israel for, more than 6 months now. And the leadership, the college president, has started bringing in police to clear out the protests because they've been so disruptive. And in the meantime, she's also shut down in-person classes. So classes are going to be virtual, which is many are viewing sort of as a surrender to the protests, that they've sort of successfully taken over the campus if it's been so disruptive that you can't hold class.
How much of this is legitimate protest and how much of this is anti-Semitism?
Look, I think everyone, who's familiar with the environment on campus knew that there were going to be pro-Palestinian protests on campus. And I think it's legitimate. We could all have different opinions and we can all see this war differently. But when it crosses the threshold into threats and harassment of students, that's when it's no longer legitimate. And frankly, I think in many cases, these campus protests cross that threshold very early on, within the first few weeks of the war, but nobody paid attention until it became so big and such a major disruption that it was affecting everyone.
So would you say it's already at the stage that on many campuses, Jewish students are afraid to go to classes?
Yeah, or afraid to cross certain parts of campus, afraid to go to their dorms even. I mean, it varies from campus to campus, but certainly in the places where these things have gotten out of control, you hear from a lot of students, whether it's the younger students who are 18, 19 years old, or even graduate students who could be, 10 years older than that, that they are afraid of the atmosphere in campus. They are afraid that there will be actual violence against them.
Do we know of any specific groups that are behind these protests and who might be funding them?
So a lot of this comes from Students for Justice in Palestine, which is an organization that's on colleges across the United States, has connections to Palestinian groups that were outlawed because of their connections to Hamas, and also was founded with funding from Qatar. That being said, I don't think I've seen reports specifically on these protests. But it's that organization, Students for Justice in Palestine, which has long had a lot of very suspicious funding, I would say.
Yesterday, we heard comments from President Biden when he was asked about anti-Semitism. He said while he condemns anti-Semitism, he also condemns what he called people who don't really understand what's going on in Palestine. This wasn't really the clear-cut condemnation of anti-Semitism that many people were hoping for, was it?
Yeah, and I think it's sort of a continuation of what his attitude has been on Israel for a long time now, for several months now, which is, they continue the aid to Israel, for which, Israelis are very grateful and it is very important to Israel. But every time Biden is asked about Israel, he has something critical to say, and to me, that's not leadership. You need to, you take a stand, then you need to stand up for it. You need to show moral clarity. And in this case, he's not showing moral clarity about a domestic anti-Semitism problem, right? The fact that he's conflating anti-Semitism with understanding the plight of Palestinians is completely unacceptable and frankly immoral, right? If somebody doesn't understand something that's happening 6,000 miles away from America. They deserve to be victims of racist harassments and threats in America. And this is, you know, what you're seeing from the college campus presidents as well. It's as if there is no actual word called anti-Semitism. It's this long compound word called anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. I'm not saying you don't have to address Islamophobia. If there's a problem, you should address it. But anti-Semitism should be tackled, you know, head on. And if it has to be combined with all these other sort of mealy-mouthed, you know, hedges, then that's not going to work. And that's the reason why, despite this problem being around for 6 months and college presidents being aware of it, remember that hearing in Congress that ended up with the resignation of the president of Harvard, that was in December already, right? But the reason that these protests kept going, I think, is because nobody was willing to call them what they are and stand up for Jews, qua Jews.
Yesterday, we saw reports that some of the major Jewish funders were withdrawing their funding from Columbia. We saw that earlier as well with Harvard, etc. Do you think this is the best way to pressure the university administrations to act more firmly?
I think it's one very good way. But I think that you have to sort of keep the pressure on, because you saw people doing that in Harvard very soon after October 7th. And then they formed a committee to fight anti-Semitism. And then people who genuinely cared about the well-being of Jews on campus soon quit that committee because they felt that it was just window dressing. You know, unless there's real and consistent pressure on these campuses, it can be from funders, it can be from Congress. It just looks like they're not that incentivized to fight the anti-Semitism.
Finally, I presume these protests will continue as long as the war in Gaza continues.
And, you know, it's fine to have protests, right? It's just that these protests have crossed the line that they have been threatening and harassing to fellow students and faculty. I wouldn't expect protests of any form, you know, of the regular peaceful form to end, because opinions differ, right? But this is more than protests.
Lahav Harkov from the Misgav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy. Taking a look at the headlines this evening, the Hamas terror group has released a propaganda video with a sign of life from captivity of Israeli-American hostage Hirsch Goldberg, Poland. The IDF chief of staff and Shin Bet chief held talks in Cairo amid Israeli military preparations for an offensive in Rafah. A pro-Qatari newspaper says Gaza Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar recently went above ground to visit sites where battles took place by Hamas terrorists against IDF troops. Defense Minister Gallant says Israel has killed half of Hezbollah's South Lebanon commanders and the rest are in hiding. U.S. President Biden signs an aid package law that includes billions of dollars in military assistance to Israel. The weather outlook, extremely hot. And as we just heard, U.S. President Joe Biden today signed a hard-fought bill into law that includes $61 billion in aid to Ukraine for its war with Russia, $26 billion in aid to Israel, as well as $1 billion in humanitarian assistance to Gaza. The measure marked a rare bipartisan victory for Biden as he seeks re-election, and it ended months of fighting with Republicans in Congress. In remarks shortly after signing the bill into law, Biden said it gives vital support to America's partners so they can defend themselves from threats to their sovereignty.
I just signed into law the national security package that was passed by the House of Representatives this weekend and by the Senate yesterday. It's going to make America safer. It's going to make the world safer. And it continues America's leadership in the world, and everyone knows it. It gives vital support to America's partners, and so they can defend themselves against threats to their sovereignty. My commitment to Israel, I want to make clear again, is ironclad. The security of Israel is critical. It will always make sure that Israel has what it needs to defend itself against Iran and terrorists it supports. And with this aid, the United States is going to help replenish Israel's air defense and provide other critical events so Iran can never carry out the destruction it intended with its attack 10 days ago. But at the same time, this bill significantly increases humanitarian assistance we're sending to the innocent people of Gaza who are suffering badly. They're suffering the consequences of this war that Hamas started. And we've been working intently for months to get as much aid to Gaza as possible. This bill includes $1 billion for additional humanitarian aid in Gaza. We're going to immediately secure that aid and surge it, including food, medical supplies, clean water. And Israel must make sure all this aid reaches the Palestinians in Gaza without delay.
U.S. President Joe Biden. The sweeping foreign aid package passed easily in the Senate, which approved it in a vote of 79 to 18, those four bills that were passed by the House of Representatives on Saturday. This after House Republican leaders abruptly switched course last week and allowed the vote on the $1 billion package in mostly military aid for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and U.S. partners in the Indo-Pacific. The four bills were combined into one package in the Senate, which President Joe Biden, as we heard, signed into law today. Here are some voices from the vote and the debate, including Senate Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, followed by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, Senator John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, and Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican from Alabama, who opposed the bill.
On this vote, the yeas are 79, the nays are 18. The motion to concur in the House amendment to the Senate amendment to H.R. 815 is agreed to.
This is an inflection point in history. Western democracy perhaps faced its greatest test since the end of the Cold War. The conflicts we see right now in Europe, in the Middle East, and the tensions of the Indo-Pacific will go a long way in shaping the balance of power between democracy and autocracy in the decades to come, and the consequences for America's long-term security will be profound. Mr. President, today, the Senate sends a unified message to the entire world. America will always defend democracy in its hour of need. We tell our allies, we will stand with you. We tell our adversaries, don't mess with us. We tell the world we will do everything to defend democracy and our way of life. In a resounding bipartisan vote, the relentless work of six long months has paid off. Congress is sending the supplemental to President Biden's desk. Getting this done was one of the greatest achievements the Senate has faced in years, perhaps decades. A lot of people inside and outside the Congress wanted this package to fail. But today, those in Congress who stand on the side of democracy are winning the day.
When Putin escalated his war against Ukraine, I told our colleagues that allies and adversaries alike would pay very close attention to America's response. When Iran-backed terrorists invaded the Jewish state on October 7th to slaughter innocent Israelis, I warned that the world would watch closely for signs that American leadership was actually weakening. For months, our friends have watched to see whether America still had the strength that won the Cold War or the resolve that has underpinned peace and prosperity literally for decades. Our enemies have tested whether the arsenal of democracy is, in fact, built to endure. Well, tonight, the Senate will send a clear message.
Madam President, in the face of increased aggression from these powers, the United States' response needs to be one of strength. And that includes not just having a strong military and a strong economy, but engaging on the global stage. As I said, bad actors will fill any space they think they can fill. And when the United States and other free countries abdicate leadership on the global stage, bad actors will step in to fill the vacuum. The foreign aid contained in this bill is an important part of telegraphing America's refusal to cede the global stage to hostile powers.
Senator,
what we're doing is a slap in the face to the Americans who sent us here to represent them. Instead of debating legislation to close the border and fix the economy, we're about to send billions of dollars to one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The war in Ukraine is a stalemate, has been for a while. Pouring more money into Ukraine coffers will only prolong the conflict and lead to more loss of life.
Senator speaking ahead of the vote to approve the foreign aid bill. Israel's Foreign Minister Yisrael Katz thanked U.S. President Joe Biden for signing into law the bill that provides wartime assistance to Israel. Meanwhile, earlier, hours after the U.S. Senate approval of the aid package, Diaspora Affairs Minister Amichai Shikli from the Likud chose to attack the U.S. president, saying that the United States under his leadership doesn't project strength. Speaking to Khan Radio, Shikli said that while it's true that Biden is a friend of Israel, he said the president is subject to heavy pressure that has impacted and has created real damage to relations between the countries. If you look at Biden's strategy and what happened in Afghanistan, in Ukraine, and in the Middle East, he said don't to Hezbollah and Iran at the beginning of the war, and we saw the outcome, Shikli said. I don't think the United States under his leadership projects strength. That has also hurt the state of Israel and a lot of other countries. If I were an American citizen with the right to vote, I would vote for Trump and the Republicans. In response to Shikli's statements, opposition leader Yair Lapid of Yesh Atid noted that they were made hours after the U.S. Senate had approved the billions of dollars in security assistance to Israel and hours before the U.S. president signed off on the assistance. This is the full-on stupid government, Lapid wrote on the social media platform X. Meanwhile, former U.S. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has sharply criticized Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that not only should IDF officers should step down, this is in the wake of the announcement by the IDF intelligence commander that he is taking responsibility and resigning from the post, but so should Netanyahu, because he is responsible for the situation.
We recognize Israel's right to protect itself. We reject the policy and the practice of Netanyahu. Terrible. What could be worse than what he has done?
Former U.S. Democratic House Majority Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Moshe Yaalon, a former chief of staff and defense minister, says the IDF intelligence director, Major General Aharon Haliva, had done the right thing to resign. Yaalon said, I think all the leaders of the defense establishment, both in the IDF and in the Shin Bet, recognize the magnitude of their responsibility for the enormous failure of October 7th. Opposition Chair Lapid wrote, the resignation of the director of military intelligence was justified and dignified. Prime Minister Netanyahu ought to do the same. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich wrote on X, it is good that Haliva resigned and took responsibility. This is an opportunity for real change and correction in building the top IDF command. And this is why the chief of staff and others who failed must not be the ones who appoint successors who are in their form and their image. Amnesty International has warned that the world is seeing a near breakdown of international law amid what it calls flagrant rule-breaking in Gaza and Ukraine, multiplying armed conflicts, the rise of authoritarianism, and huge rights violations in Sudan, Ethiopia, and Myanmar. In its annual report published today, the human rights organization charged that the most powerful governments, including the United States, Russia, and China, have led a global disregard for international rules and values enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, with civilians in conflicts paying the highest price. Israel has expressed regret over the German government's plans to resume cooperation with the UN Agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, in Gaza. The decision follows a review by the former French foreign minister, Catherine Colonna, into UNRWA's ability to ensure neutrality and respond to any breaches after Israel's allegations that 12 of its staff took part in the Hamas-led October 7th attacks. The Colonna-led review of the agency's neutrality on Monday concluded that Israel had yet to back up its accusations that hundreds of UNRWA staff were operatives in Gaza terror groups. The German government urged UNRWA to swiftly implement the report's recommendations, including strengthening its internal audit function and improving external oversight of project management. Israel has called a whitewash the report that was released this week by the review panel headed by Colonna. In an online briefing, government spokesperson David Mentzer said Israel calls on countries that previously funded UNRWA to instead direct their money toward other humanitarian organizations in the Gaza Strip. He also reiterated Israel's rejection of claims by Hamas that IDF forces left mass graves of Palestinians at two Gaza hospitals, confirming the IDF had exhumed a number of corpses buried by Palestinians on the grounds of a hospital based on information that they could be those of hostages, but treated them with utmost respect.
Needless to say, the claims are baseless and false. During the IDF's operation in the area of Nasser Hospital, now, this is unpleasant, unfortunately, we tried to locate hostages and missing persons, corpses, buried by Palestinians in the area of the Nasser Hospital. The examination was conducted in a careful manner, only in places where our intelligence pointed to the presence of hostages. The examination was carried out respectfully, while maintaining the dignity of the deceased. Bodies were examined, and which did not belong to Israeli hostages, and they were returned to their place. And so a libel was born and repeated the world over, like the famine libel. There is no famine in Gaza. Pictures show markets bustling with food in the north and southern Gaza. 357 aid trucks is the daily amount of aid trucks which have gone in the last day. 700 trucks worth of aid are waiting to be picked up on the Gazan side of Keren Shalom. 700 aid trucks worth of aid. All that aid waiting to be distributed by a thoroughly inefficient United Nations. Food aplenty in Gaza. Next to UNRWA, you know, Hamas has infiltrated UNRWA. We've said that many, many times, so deeply that it's in fact no longer possible to determine where UNRWA ends and Hamas begins. So we say this again. Here are the facts. More than 2,135 UNRWA workers are members of either Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad, prescribed terrorist organizations. One-fifth of UNRWA's school administrators are Hamas members. It's not a few bad apples. It's a rotten and poisonous tree whose roots are Hamas. The latest Colonna report ignores the severity of the problem and offers cosmetic solutions that do not deal with the enormous scope of Hamas's infiltration of UNRWA. It's sadly a whitewash. This is not what a genuine, thorough review looks like. This is what an effort to avoid the problem and not address it head-on looks like. Israel today calls on the donor countries to refrain from transferring their taxpayers' money, their hard-earned taxpayers' money, to UNRWA, Gaza, as these funds will go to fund Hamas, the Hamas terrorist organization. And that violates legislation in the donor countries themselves. Israel calls on the donor countries to transfer their funds to other humanitarian organizations in Gaza.
David Mentzer, a spokesperson at the National Public Diplomacy Directorate. Before the weather and return headlines, here is the Don Reichel Project, Achshav Karov. Closer.
Tikvot gdolot עוד נסע הרוח חזרה שלכת זיכרונות בכל דבר אז בי נוגע כל נפלאות היום אז בואי ועמדי לרגע עכשיו אליו נשים תפילות אור שתקוות עוטף אותנו זה לתמיד ולא יחלוף בכל דבר אז בי נוגע כל נפלאות
Look, extremely hot tomorrow over most of the country. Strong winds in the morning in the northern and central hills and along the northern coast. Cooler and more humid air entering the region from the afternoon, with haze developing mostly in the south. Friday will be much cooler, but still hot for the time of year. Saturday, cooler with a chance of local rain, mostly light. The temperatures forecast for tonight and tomorrow. Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, 23 to 36. Haifa, 23 to 37. Tzfat, 22 to 31. Tiberias, 19 to 40. Beersheva, 26 to 39. And in Eilat, from 25 degrees tonight, going up to 39 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Taking another look at the news headlines this evening, the Hamas terror group has released a propaganda video with a first sign of life from captivity of Israeli-American hostage Hirsch Goldberg Pollen. His family said in response to that release, "Hirsch, we heard your voice today for the first time in 201 days. If you can hear us, we are telling you we love you. Stay strong. Survive." The Hostages Families Forum headquarters called for an immediate deal to release all the hostages. The IDF chief of staff and Shin Bet chief held talks in Cairo as the Israeli military prepares for an offensive in Rafah. Defense Minister Gallant says Israel has killed half of Hezbollah's South Lebanon commanders. The rest are in hiding. U.S. President Biden signs an aid package into law that includes billions of dollars in military assistance to Israel. The weather outlook, extremely hot. That's the news. Join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m. on Kan Reka, the foreign languages channel of the Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation. Watch our 2 p.m. news flash on the Kan English Facebook page. Find us on Spotify, Twitter, or write to us at kanenglish@kan.org.il. Together with sound engineer Nadav Nir, this is Naomi Segal wishing you good evening, Moadim LaSimcha, and Shalom from Jerusalem.